Cast comes from the Seaboat, with a southern style of cooking catfish, chicken, and shrimp, featuring the Seaboat sandwich, two pieces of fish on a wheat bun with lettuce, tomato, and tartar sauce, and desserts like sweet potato pie. The Seaboat at Bradley and Market in Champaign. Delivery and catering services at 351-6209.
This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580 and online at WILL.UIUC.EDU. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. Thanks for tuning in today. On the program today, we look back at the presidency of Bill Clinton. Our guest is Washington Post journalist John Harris. Harris began covering the Clinton White House in 1995, just after the Republicans, under the leadership of Newt Gingrich, captured Congress. He continued reporting on the administration through its conclusion in 2001 when George W. Bush took the oath of office. John Harris has now written a history of the Clinton presidency. The book, The Survivor, Bill Clinton in the White House, begins with a glimpse into the first campaign and wraps up with a look at the argument over Clinton's legacy. In between, readers will find a detailed report on the inner workings of the Clinton White House and its successes and failures in dealing with the events of the period at home and abroad. Listeners, I invite you to join the discussion with your questions and comments. You can join us with a telephone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, call toll-free, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. John Harris is the recipient of several awards for his work as a journalist. His book, The Survivor, Bill Clinton in the White House, is published by Random House. His website is www.johnfharris.com. 333-9455, 800-222-9455. Mr. Harris, thanks so much for joining us. Welcome.
Hi, Celeste.
At this moment in time, how does the Clinton presidency look?
Well, Bill Clinton was a nonstop argument for all 8 years, and certainly the six of the 8 years I covered him. He was the center of American politics, a constant argument about him. The last chapter of my book is called Argument Without End, and I think that does still describe the reality. Democrats look at him as having a highly favorable contrast with President Bush. Republicans, I think, don't have the visceral hatred that they did for him during the 1990s. I think people come back to look at him, as even his adversaries, as a colorful character and in some ways an American original. However, they have transferred those visceral feelings toward Hillary Clinton as she runs for president in 2008. I expect she will. We're going to hear these arguments. His historical legacy, I think, is still unsettled. One reason I wanted to write this book is to try to come at this not from an ideological point of view, but from an objective and fair-minded view. Well, memories were still fresh. This was an interview-driven book, and I wanted to convey in the pages what it was like to be around Clinton. What was the texture and the mood of the important moments inside the White House?
Yeah. Early on in this book, we see a man of appetite. It worked for him and against him. Do you think he was blind to that being a vulnerability?
Yes, at times I do think that he doesn't see himself terribly clearly. Perhaps none of us really do. We can't fully see how we look to outsiders or what seems obvious to other people. I think he didn't fully understand the extent to which his appetites, and I don't mean that I mean that in a multitude of different ways, his appetite for life, his appetite for food. Obviously, the presidency was marred by sexual excess. I don't think he did have a vivid view of just how much trouble these appetites could get him in and how they were going to limit his ambitions that he carried with him really from the time he was a small child in Arkansas. He always dreamed of himself as living on a historic stage of achieving great things. He did achieve some very large things, but he also made some huge miscalculations and misjudgments that undeniably weigh on his historical legacy.
Mm. As I mentioned in my introduction at the outset of the book, you give readers a glimpse of the very early days of a campaign, the first campaign. And you say the early days are absent motorcades and banners and all the rest. At its inception, you say, a presidential campaign looks more like this. Four guys sitting in a hotel bar. Who were the three guys with Clinton in the bar at the outset of the 92 campaign?
Yeah, that is, I thought, a revealing scene. All four of the people would eventually become famous at the time. None of them were. It was Bill Clinton. This was, by the way, in the fall of 1991. And at that point, Bill Clinton could walk into a Washington hotel, as that's where this meeting was taking place, and he wouldn't turn a head. Nobody knew who he was. With him was Bruce Lindsay, who was his close advisor, who stayed with him through all 8 years. What they were doing was looking for political consultants to run their campaign. They were trying to find who they thought would be the most effective campaign strategist. So it was an interview with famous name James Carville and his sidekick, Paul Begala. As Begala later explained the meeting to me, it was just a transforming experience for him because he had never sat down and talked with a politician who was this good. And he said, interestingly, what Bill Clinton talked about was not campaign strategy and polls. He came and gave the consultants his view of why he was running for president, what he thought was wrong with the country, what he proposed to do about it. It was Bill Clinton at his best and striking all the right chords of idealism in these consultants. They came away thinking, we have got to work for this guy. And they did, and ultimately became the two strategists for that 1992 campaign.
Yeah. Begala, as you know, was hooked. It was like, you know, he had a crush on this guy. But he was also asking himself, is this guy for real? And it's a question he asked himself on more than one occasion. It's a great question. How has Begala answered the question over the years? How do others answer it? And how do you answer it?
Sure. Yeah, and I think we all do ask ourselves that question at different times with Bill Clinton because his strengths are so obvious, but then so are his weaknesses, and how do we reconcile these two? Paul Begala is an interesting man. He's a devout Catholic, and he was, at a very personal level, deeply offended by Bill Clinton's conduct during the whole Lewinsky affair. And found it deeply disillusioning. Although he didn't leave the Clinton fold, he reconciled himself to it and decided to stay and fight, although I think he had considered leaving the administration in disgust. I think he's come over time to a realistic view. He's not likely to have a crush for Bill Clinton the way he did at that very first meeting. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, he thinks that he was Bill Clinton's a consequential figure in recent American history. He's proud of having worked for him. As a reporter, you asked me my views. Mm-hmm. As a reporter, and as for this book, as a historian, you know, I think maybe I'm temperamentally like this. Certainly, it's my professional obligation. I do have a certain amount of detachment. And a lot of reporters did when they first came across Bill Clinton, did swoon over him because he is a formidable talent and he's an interesting guy. I came into the game a little bit later in 1995. Certainly didn't have that feeling. When I first arrived covering the Clinton White House, I felt almost as though I was covering a cadaver. He was a beaten man. Newt Gingrich had just taken over the Congress. That was the year of the GOP takeover. And Clinton just was – he looked dormant. He was low in the polls For a natural politician like this, it's reflected in – when he's doing poorly politically, it's reflected in him almost physically. He was drawn, shrunken man. Over the course of the next year, I saw him really execute one of the great political comebacks in modern American history. I guess my view of Clinton has always been of Clinton the politician who will do what it takes to survive. He will always no matter what happens, come back to fight another day. And that's certainly one of the most admirable things about him. And yet it's also one of the most frustrating things about him. He's almost always somebody who's preserving his options.
He's known as the comeback kid. He's also known as Slick Willie. What's allowed him to return time after time from disaster? What is it in his character that allows him to do this? Why is he a survivor?
I think the root of it is that you mentioned that word appetite, and I do think the root of it, both his success and obviously in some cases his failure, comes back to that hunger to succeed, almost that visceral need to succeed as a politician, that was something that manifested itself with Bill Clinton at a very, very early age. And, you know, by the time he was a late teenager, he had decided on it, that he was going to pursue a life in politics and had decided that he was going to someday become president. Interestingly enough, the people who were around him at that young age also saw that. So that hunger, I think, is, you know, as so often with most of these human traits, it's both sides of the coin. It's his strength and his weakness. The hunger is what makes him a survivor. The hunger is also, in some cases, what gets him in the middle of crises from which he needs to fight to survive.
Yeah. His second grade teacher told his mother, "Your boy could be president someday." So it goes way, way back.
Yes, it does.
And was it also encouraged in him by teachers, by family, this hunger?
Bill Clinton's mother, Virginia Kelly, you know, she doted on her boy. And she had known quite a lot of adversity in her life, too, and had that same sort of lifelong pattern. No matter how bad things are, you put on a happy face and keep going. And Bill Clinton credits her with this sort of this dimension of his personality that we're discussing, the ability to keep fighting through adversity. And I think that's probably right. She wasn't a political woman. In terms of politics, I think Bill Clinton is, in large measure, self-taught.
Journalist John Harris is our guest this afternoon here on The Afternoon Magazine. He is the author of The Survivor, Bill Clinton in the White House. John Harris is national correspondent for The Washington Post. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, you can join us this afternoon with questions, comments. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Something that surprised me in this book, The Survivor, was, you know, given when I think of Bill Clinton, I think of a very dynamic man, but he is also a very passive man. And you say it was a feature of his governing style. Talk with us about that.
Well, we don't think of Bill Clinton as a passive man because obviously we think of him as an energetic and almost hyperactive man, and that's all true. When I mention this passivity, what I mean is – and it goes to the essence of his nature as a survivor. He is somebody who will always want to survey all the options. He'll want to keep those options open as long as he can. He'll want to defer and delay making decisions and thereby defining himself, because to choose is to define who you are and what you stand for. He's going to want to wait as long as he can to do that. And that at times can lead to a certain passivity because he has a mind that focuses on shades of gray. He's not somebody that sees the world in black and white. That can be paralyzing for him. Ultimately, he when forced to choose, my view of his presidency is that on policy grounds, not necessarily always personally, he made responsible choices. But the presidency was marked by numerous instances where Bill Clinton was reluctant to take bold action initially.
We have a listener waiting to talk with us. Let's go and talk with this caller in Champaign waiting for us on line one. Hi. Do we have a listener there? Caller on line one? No? Well, perhaps if we've lost them, he or she will call back. 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. 1-800-259-9455. Let me ask my director. Henry, do you think we should try again there on line one? Okay. Line one, listener in Champaign? No, they're not there, obviously, this time. We can hear that. Well, let's talk about this feature of his character, his passivity, and how it could be at times paralyzing. How did that affect his staff? How did that affect the workings of the White House?
For subordinates who didn't know how to sort of get in a groove with Bill Clinton, it could be enormously frustrating. For those who understood or came to understand through experience what it was he was looking for advisors, they could thrive under it. What I mean by this is because Bill Clinton is somebody who can see shades of gray and who understands complexity and if he's not careful can be paralyzed by that complexity, what he looks for in advisors is somebody who can push him to clarity, who can present him with black and white choices and say, here's what you must do. You must do this. If you do it, you'll succeed. If you don't do it, you'll fail. Now, he doesn't take anybody's advice and just swallow it wholesale. But that's what he seems to appreciate, is people who can help him, push him to clarity. You know, at different times in his life, people who have played that role, the most important is Hillary Clinton. She's somebody who was known in the White House as a closer, who can cut through the debate and say, okay, it's an either-or choice. What are we going to do? In 1995 and 96, when Bill Clinton's fighting back after the humiliation of the 94 elections, the person who played that black and white role was Dick Morris, the political consultant. He came and gave Clinton the certitude and therefore the confidence that he needed to act. Al Gore at different times played that role and helped push Clinton to overcome his doubts, for instance, over what to do in Bosnia, the horrible ethnic warfare there in the early 90s. For 2 years of his presidency, 93 and 94, Clinton was wringing his hands over what to do, wanted to stop the war, didn't want to commit, take the political risk of really committing the United States to do something. Ultimately, it was Gore and some other people who pushed Clinton toward what I think was a very honorable outcome, the Dayton Peace Accord of 1995. Which was politically risky. American troops were on the ground over there. Clinton had great misgivings about it, but ultimately did what I think history would recognize as the right thing.
What happened when it came to Rwanda?
Rwanda was, as your listeners know, was a horrible genocide that took place in the spring of 1994. In the space of a couple of months, 800,000 people were killed. Clinton has subsequently called it his greatest regret as president that the United States, for that matter other countries in the West, basically averted their gaze from Rwanda. Interestingly, that was never one of those agonizing choices that I've described, should we or shouldn't we. It just never came up in the White House. It was seen as so far beyond the realm of something that was politically possible or conceivable. There was never a decision not to go to Rwanda. It just wasn't ever debated.
Did Somalia have something to do with that?
It had everything to do with that. In his first year as president, he inherited a peacekeeping mission in Somalia from his predecessor, George Bush 41. That mission went terribly awry, and due to some miscalculations that Clinton and his foreign policy advisors made, 19 Americans lost their life. You know, these days we are accustomed, sadly, to hearing of service personnel being killed at you know, fortunately a high rate, but at the time that was devastating to the Clinton administration, in part because the American people really didn't think that we had a role in Somalia and belonged there. Clinton paid a terrible price for that mission, and the administration was so seared by it that the idea of 6 months later making a major troop commitment to end genocide in Rwanda was just it was beyond the pale. Never discussed.
What would you mentioned Al Gore. What would you like to say about the relationship between Bill Clinton and Al Gore?
Well, it obviously has tragic dimensions in that it was at one level the most intimate and productive presidential and vice presidential relationship in history. Bill Clinton authentically liked having Al Gore around. he got confidence from Gore's recommendations, in part because Al Gore is himself a politician. Clinton always liked to get advice from people who have run for office because he felt they were the only people who could really understand the dimensions of a decision. You know, it's easy for staff people to push one view or the other on a president, but his view is like, look, they've never faced the voters. Gore had. Clinton respected him for that and gave him really unprecedented influence. Beneath the surface of that relationship that was so intimate in policy and in political grounds, the fact is they were never especially close at the personal level. In the book, I describe Gore mentioning to one of his aides. One of his aides says, look, you know, I was invited to the White House theater to watch a movie. And Gore looked at his aide and said, you know, in 6 years they've never once invited us. I obviously felt a little bit you know, put out by that. They weren't close at the personal level. Hillary Clinton was not especially close. I think it's fair to say didn't particularly like the Gores. So the relationship was always very complex. And then, of course, this complexity came out in public view in the 2000 campaign where you know, the Gores felt that Bill Clinton's irresponsibility in the Lewinsky matter was one of the big obstacles that he had to confront running for president in 2000, and the relationship badly ruptured.
Hmm. You mentioned Monica Lewinsky. You know, the view from the Clinton White House was, you know, that should be regarded as private, a private matter. How did the Lewinsky scandal affect the vitality of the Clinton administration? What was its effect?
It was, for a year, arguably more than a year, it was a cancer. At the time, the White House was describing, they invented this new word, or they put into popular currency this new word, compartmentalization. That's supposedly what President Clinton did, that he was able to focus on his work, and the Lewinsky thing was somehow in a separate box in his mind, and this supposedly wasn't a distraction. And Clinton was such a good performer in public that a lot of people believed this. The fact is that was a complete myth. It was illusion. I describe in the book and quote from his aides who just how distracted Clinton could be. They'd walk in to – they'd watch him in meetings and he'd be off 1,000 yards away, paying little attention to it. The chief of staff at that time, Erskine Bowles, would come into the Oval Office and Clinton would be in another world playing with the political buttons. He likes to collect campaign buttons and had a collection of these in the Oval Office. And when he was feeling especially beleaguered, he'd rearrange his collection of buttons, completely lost in thought. So at the personal level, not surprisingly, Clinton was overwhelmed. This threatened his marriage. It threatened his presidency. It threatened his historical legacy. So, of course, he was obsessed with it. Now, politically, I also think it's very important. Bill Clinton's great strength as president and as a Democrat was that he, at times, would force his party to do things that went somewhat against the grain. Deficit reduction in the 1993 budget plan, again in 1997. Democrats aren't really crazy about deficit reduction. It was Clinton that had to force them to that. Also with trade, an issue that lots of Democrats are ambivalent about, free trade. Clinton was a free trader and pushed his party, look, we've got to accept the reality of trade. Welfare reform, we've got to accept the reality that the system needs to be fixed. All those things involved pushing his party. Once the Monica Lewinsky story broke in 1998, that game was over. Republicans were trying to evict Clinton from power. He needed all the Democratic support he could get. He was no longer in a position to push his party on things like Social Security reform, tackling the big Medicare problem. In a lot of ways, he was now hostage to his fellow Democrats.
Mm. So he was distracted in his political capital.
Yes, in just an infinite number of ways. And so I think there's a tendency, and certainly President Clinton, I think, you know, feeds this this perception that, you know, Republicans were obsessed with this, but it never affected me. He was acquitted at the impeachment trial, which is true. Therefore, the whole thing ended up being inconsequential. You know, unfortunately, that is not the case. It was It was a big distraction that in a lot of ways prematurely ended his second term.
And what about our security? Did it affect our security as a nation? Should we have been paying more attention at the time to the threat of terrorism?
Well, just to ask the question is in some ways to answer it, yeah. That of course we should have. The Clinton record on terrorism is a complicated one, and I think we have to be fair. To me, the tragedy of it was that Bill Clinton understood as well as anybody, better than almost anybody, the threat that terrorism posed to the United States in this new era. You know, there's this interesting scene on 9/11. Clinton was in Australia, and some of his aides, Bruce Lindsay, who we mentioned earlier, happened to be in New York at the time the first plane hit. And they quickly called Clinton in Australia, and they were on the phone with him when the second plane hit. And the first words out of Clinton's mouth were, "Osama bin Laden did this." He knew exactly what was who was the likely culprit of this, even though most of us at that time didn't know bin Laden's name. Bill Clinton understood the threat of terrorism. What he wasn't able to do was to infuse his entire government with the sense of urgency that he felt. You were asking me earlier about passivity. This is an example of it. Every time he made recommendations, different agencies in his government would almost always come back with different reservations or complaints or reasons why action couldn't be taken. And Clinton didn't tend to resist this. You know, Richard Clark, the anti-terrorism czar who got a lot of publicity a year ago due to the 9/11 report, he told me in an interview that he thought Clinton he also agreed with this idea of Clinton as somewhat passive. He said Bill Clinton would say he wants to do things, and he'd just assume that because he had asked for it that these things were being done. That's not the way government works. The only way things really change in the federal government is you've got a president sort of demanding and following up and agitating to make sure that his ideas and policies are followed through. That wasn't in Clinton's nature. Mm-hmm. And interestingly, you know, one of the most important anti-terrorism positions is director of the FBI. Clinton had a horribly dysfunctional relationship with Louis Freeh. They basically didn't talk the entire second term. Clinton would have loved nothing but nothing more than to fire Louis Freeh. Who he had all kinds of complaints with, both personal and policy, but he couldn't do it because he felt that if he did, everybody would assume that he was firing Freeh for political reasons. My view is I don't think a president should ever be in the position where he can be held hostage to a subordinate, as Bill Clinton was with Louis Freeh.
Hmm. Journalist John Harris, our guest this afternoon here on the Afternoon Magazine. He is national correspondent for the Washington Post, the author of The Survivor, Bill Clinton in the White House. Our guest, John Harris, began covering the Clinton White House in 1995. He continued reporting on the administration through its conclusion in 2001 when George W. Bush took the oath of office. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, I invite you to join us this afternoon with your questions. Join the discussion with questions, comments, 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455, 333-WILL, 800-222-WILL. It seems on the occasions when Bill Clinton seemed bold that his timing was off. For instance, I'm thinking of his commitment to health care reform, but I can't help but wondering if he hadn't gone before Congress and the nation in his State of the Union address in January 1994 and demanded legislation. If he hadn't done that then, if he had worked on some of his other ideas, then he might have stood a better chance.
Oh, sure. You're absolutely right. That is one of the great what-ifs of the Clinton administration, is if they had pursued a less ambitious agenda at the outset of the presidency on health care and had done some other things that would be more likely to win bipartisan support, specifically welfare reform, which was something that appealed to a lot of Republicans, what might have been different. I think quite a lot would have been different. Democrats today still suffer the consequences of that 94 election. Republicans took control of Congress, and in the House, they've never given it up. In the Senate, they've given it up for just a year of those last 12. I think it's unlikely that would have happened if Bill Clinton had made some different choices in 1994. You know, interestingly, he was dying to somehow split the difference with Republicans and find a compromise. One person who wasn't, and in fact was a major impediment to that kind of middle-of-the-road approach on health care, was, interestingly enough, Hillary Clinton, who's since said publicly what a mistake that was. But she was the one in those early years who was pushing Clinton toward the more ambitious approach on health care and on some other issues. In the 94 election, when that strategy was proven wrong, she was personally just devastated. She summoned a political advisor and was in tears and said, "I don't know what to do. Everything I thought was right was wrong. Everything I thought was up is now down." As much as Bill Clinton, she was devastated and just bereft of confidence in that 95 time period, and ultimately had to, just like he did, invent a new brand of politics.
Hmm. Let's talk with a listener in Champaign, line one. Hello.
Hello. I'm digressing a bit. I did have the good fortune of meeting Bill Clinton while we both took the Arkansas bar exam.
Sure.
And back in 1973, summer of 73, and one of my colleagues pointed Bill Clinton out by alluding to him. He was from Hot Springs along with Bill Clinton, by saying that guy will one day be president of the United States, and I thought he was he should have been taken to the local state hospital. But sure shooting, Bill Clinton did become president of the United States. So apparently in Hot Springs, where Bill Clinton spent most of his life, there was an aura about him where people thought he had what it took to rise to the heights of being president of the United States. And I just wanted to let you have that personal statement from
me. Yeah, you know, isn't that amazing? His entire life, there have been stories like that of people who identified him as a future president from a young age.
Yeah, and he was in somewhat of a disheveled state at that time. I had no clue, but sure as shooting, he did. Now, my question to you, and I'm African American, is in my home state of Arkansas, I'm like Bill Clinton, I'm a native of Arkansas. He's now a member, an honorary member of the Arkansas Black Hall of Fame. And he also is Toni Morrison's first black president. And he seems to be, among blacks I know, except for a few, very much enamored by those blacks. I look at his policies in terms of incarceration of black folk primarily, the No Child Left Behind, the welfare reform, which Peter Adelman left because it didn't leave a safety net for poor kids, disproportionately black kids. And this centrist notion that he and some Democrats took to gain the presidency, I don't think his record is deserving of being, quote, the first black president. Am I wrong in that assessment?
Well, you're far from the only person that's had that assessment. I think that, you know, at times we've heard Reverend Jesse Jackson make similar critique. You know, he is on balance a supporter of Bill Clinton, but at many times had misgivings about some of the policies this caller mentions. And in fact, once told me that he said Bill Clinton's heart, Bill Clinton governs in part with his heart. And I trust his heart, but he also governs with his finger. It's a wet finger in the wind.
Yeah, I think he's a weather man. If that's what Reverend Jackson was alluding to, I think Bill Clinton governs and what will help Bill Clinton. I have, quite frankly, never forgiven Bill Clinton for the Rwanda debacle. And I know Bill Clinton was leery of doing that simply because of Somalia. And if you let a genocide take place where 800,000-plus people die, as you stand idly by, I cannot see how you deserve to be called the first black president. I just don't believe a black president whose principles would have allowed that to happen. That's just my view of Bill Clinton. It may sound harsh, but I have that view, and I hate to hear people get accolades that they haven't deserved with their policies. That's just my view, however.
Right. You know, it would be interesting is to think of whether if Rwanda had happened later in Bill Clinton's presidency, what he would have done. He came into office, and particularly in 93 and 94, had so little confidence on the foreign stage. And over time, that confidence grew. And it's interesting to sort of contemplate if Rwanda had happened in, say, 1999, whether Bill Clinton would have responded with more force to stop genocide.
Well,
I think it's
I still think he was even leery of losing ground troops in Bosnia because, contrary to another Arkansan's view, General Clark, he won that war basically through airstrikes and with little commitment of ground troops, which many generals and military people thought was impossible.
Right, so right. I know what you mean. Although I think you mean Kosovo. Bosnia
Kosovo
was in 95.
Yeah,
but you're talking about the air war of 1999,
right.
Where Bill Clinton did respond much more quickly to stop ethnic cleansing in Kosovo than he did earlier in Bosnia. But you're right. You're exactly right to say that he put a clear limit on it. He was willing to risk some through an air war, but he wasn't willing to risk the possibility of ground troops.
Right. So I just think Bill was more risk-averse than we would think. He is a quintessential politician. He's a policy wonk. But I think when it came to implementation, he was very risk-averse, and that affected will affect his legacy as a president, in my estimation.
Yeah, I agree with that assessment. But we might not agree on all the specific issues you mentioned, but your take is basically mine, that he is somebody that's highly attuned to risk, and at times that was something that inhibited him from action that where he himself would later say that it was justified.
I want to thank the listener for his call this afternoon. Invite others to join us. We've got about 8 minutes left in this portion of the program. Our guest, John Harris, national correspondent for The Washington Post and author of The Survivor, Bill Clinton in the White House. It is, you know, you mentioned Rwanda in terms of how early it was in his presidency, relatively early. But when he came into office, he had no honeymoon in the first 100 days, and right away he had a budget problem, he had big foreign policy issues, he had Haiti, the Balkans, Somalia,
right.
Rwanda.
Right. Yeah, you know, he often mentions this. He said his honeymoon was over before he even took the oath of office, and I think in a lot of ways that's right. Remember that horrible transition he had where a new president and he was only elected with 43% of the vote. It's worth reminding people probably wouldn't have been elected in 1992 except for the Perot vote, which ended up hurting President Bush more than it hurt the Democrats. And instantly walked into the buzzsaw of different controversies, including the whole gays and the military uproar. Bill Clinton definitely felt at the time, I think he still feels, burned by that fact that Republicans went on the attack against him from day one. There wasn't an attempt to work constructively with him to govern. That's his view. And I think that's a pretty accurate view. You know, they were on his case really right from the start because they saw him as as somebody who came into office weakened, and so there wasn't this honeymoon.
Yeah,
you're exactly right about that.
And why was there this animosity right from the get-go? It seems between Clinton, both Bill Clinton and Hillary Clinton, and the Washington Press Corps.
They came into power with some very deep resentments over how they were covered in the 1992 campaign, and specifically some of the scandals that broke that year. You know, these are all names from the past now, but the Jennifer Flowers case, the draft, the stories about the draft. Clinton had never received coverage like this before, and They deeply resented it, arrived in power with deep grievances. I'd say additionally, it just was not just in those first couple of years, but really I think throughout, there's an element of oil and water when it comes to the Clintons. They don't particularly understand reporting and aren't particularly sympathetic to it. You know, Paul Begala is the one who told me this. You know, at the end of the day, Clinton just doesn't respect reporters. He respects political adversaries more than people in the press corps. He sees us, you know, I have to say, it's right to some degree we're observers rather than participants, and Clinton had more respect for the participants. He just didn't get the press corps and felt that we were constantly on his case over small things and felt that we were constantly reducing every question to a question of politics and political motives. This was definitely a turbulent relationship for the full 8 years.
Yeah. I've got another listener waiting to talk with us. I'm going to get to this caller right away here, but I do want to ask this question. Here's another what if. What if the Clintons had just handed over everything to the press about Whitewater?
Oh, they would have been so much better off, because I think if they had done that, that would have reduced a lot of the pressure that was on them to appoint a special prosecutor, which they ultimately did. And the special prosecutor, it wasn't initially Ken Starr, but he took the job over subsequently, and the rest of that story is a long and troubled history. Yeah. But there would have been no prosecutor, might never have been a Lewinsky case if it hadn't been for that. It was just a critical misjudgment in my view, and one of those what ifs that will haunt them for a long time.
Yeah. Let's talk with another listener now in Urbana, line one. Hi.
Yeah, hi. I think that Bill Clinton was the last post-war president, and what I mean by that is that When Clinton was in office, it really was the economy, stupid. And I think that with 9/11 and everything that's and the stock market crash and everything else, I think this whole post-war U.S. prosperity is very much kind of, you know, come to the end of an era, and that what you were seeing in the 1990s was the Republicans knew that. And they were basically getting started on all this stuff that's been going on since then. And it just, you know, in 2000 and 2001, it just, you know, became, you know, much more obvious so that, you know, most people could see it.
Yeah, you may be right. If Bill Clinton's the last post-war president, I think it's also fair to point out he may have been the only post-war president, because up until George Bush 41, our politics was defined by the Cold War. Now it's defined by the war against terrorism. There is a view, and I tend to think it's the right view, that says one reason the politics of the 1990s was so prone to distraction, sex scandals and controversies over things that in retrospect seem really trivial, like the White House travel office, is because it was in this vacuum. People had a sense that the stakes weren't as high. The Cold War was over. Nothing had taken its place. And so it was we were more the mystique of the presidency was diminished, and we were more prone to this kind of politics of distraction.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree. I think the one big time I disagreed with Clinton was where he tried to use the same formula advising John Kerry. And I think really it really was about terrorism in 2004 and all this other stuff. And anyway, I guess we can all look back to the good old days when we didn't have to deal with all that.
Right.
Anyway, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Thanks for the call this afternoon. I'm sorry, we're running up against the clock here now. Before we go, John, you know, when I watch the press corps in Washington at work, it's so difficult to watch them, and this is over the course of a number of administrations now. You know, you don't get the answer. The question isn't answered. The question isn't answered. The question isn't answered. What's the reward of working in the Washington press corps? That's part of the challenge of it. What are the rewards of the job?
Well, I find politics interesting. I find politicians interesting. I don't have a negative view of politics. I think it's a worthwhile endeavor, and I think most people who get into it and they all have flaws. And you know, the president I covered obviously had many of his flaws put on public display. They're nonetheless fascinating people, and understanding what makes them tick is an interesting exercise. I've certainly got some people on my list who I'd consider exceptions to this, but I basically don't think politicians are bad people. I think they're noble people trying to do what's right. To me, that struggle of how they do what's right and also what's possible, that tension between the two, is what makes the whole game fun to watch.
Hmm. Thanks for being with us this afternoon.
Yeah, thanks so much.
John F. Harris has been our guest this afternoon here on the Afternoon Magazine. His book, The Survivor, Bill Clinton in the White House. You can find John Harris on the web at www.johnfharris.com. And at that website, there's a blog, and you can read an excerpt from the book. The book is published by Random House. By the way, this Friday afternoon, we will join National Public Radio for an interview with Bill Clinton. Mr. Clinton is scheduled to be interviewed by Neil Conan live at 1:06 Central Time. That's this Friday, June 3rd, 2005, here on AM 580 and online at WILL.UIUC.edu. 8 minutes before 2 o'clock, let's find out what happened today on the Chicago Board of Trade. Here's Dave Dickey.
Thank you very much, Celeste. And just a quick programming note, with that President Clinton interview scheduled for Friday, the settlements from the Chicago Board of Trade and the Mercantile Exchange will be folded into the closing market report on Friday afternoon. That gets underway at 2:06. USDA's Soybean Rust Monitoring website published an account today that soybean rust has likely spread beyond the two confirmed counties in southern Georgia. That, along with higher crude oil futures, gave soybeans a kick in the pants to turn around to higher trading today on the Chicago Board of Trade. We'll take a look at the soybeans in just a minute, but first we begin, as we always do, with the wheat. July wheat at 335 for a high, a low of 329, settling 331 and a half down a quarter. September, a high of 344 and a half, a low of 338 and a half, settling 341 and a half down three quarters. December, a high of 354, a low of 348 and a half, settling 350 and three quarters, up a half. March, a high of 363, a low of 359, settling 360 and a half, up one. July corn, a high of 225 and a half, a low of 221 and a quarter, settling 224 and a half, up 2.5. September, a high of 233 and three quarters, a low of 229 and a half, settling 233 and a quarter, up 2.5. And that up 2.5 is going to be a very familiar theme, as that's where it finished all across the pit today. December, a high of 244 and a half, a low of 238 and a quarter, settling 241 and three quarters, yes, up 2.5. March, a high of 250 and a quarter, a low of 246 and a half, settling 249 and a half, up 2.5. And then May, the one contract that was a slightly contrary, a high of 255, a low of 251 and a half, settling 254 and a quarter, up 2.25. And then the July, a high of 258 and three quarters, a low of 255 and a half, settling 258 and a half, up 2.5. July oats, a high of 142, a low of 136 and a half, settling 139 and three quarters, up 4. September, a high of 146 and a half, a low of 143, settling 144 and a quarter, up 1. July soybeans, a high of 690, a low of 673 and a half, settling 685 and a quarter, up 5. August, a high of 690, a low of 675, settling 686 and three quarters, up 5 and a quarter. September, a high of 690, a low of 675, settling 688 and a half, up 7.5. November, a high of 691 and a half, a low of 675 and three quarters, settling 689 and three quarters, up 7 and three quarters. January, a high of 691, a low of 676 and a half, settling 688 and a half, up 7. And March, a high of 683, a low of 670, settling 683 on the high, up 8 and a half on the day. July soybean meal, a high of 217.80, a low of 212.30, settling 215.60, up 90 cents. August, a high of 217.80, a low of 212.50, settling 215.90, up $1.20. July soybean oil, a high of 23.53, a low of 23.02, settling 23.50, up 35. In August, a high of 23.60, a low of 23.11, settling 23.58, up 32. Remember, we'll be back at 2:06 on the closing market report, where Paul Cooley will check in and talk about the markets. The settlement prices are also in on the Chicago Mercantile Exchange, where Celeste, except for the pork bellies, we put in a down day today.
Sure did. Feeder cattle, live cattle, and lean hogs all lower today. Let's begin with August feeder cattle, 112.75, the high 111.75, the low. The settlement 111.80, down 87 and a half. September 111.40, the high 110.72 and a half, the low. The settlement 110.72 and a half, and that down 70. October 110.20, the high 109.40, the low 109.45, the settlement. That down 70. June live cattle, 85.15, the high, the low 84.25, the settlement 84.45, that down 97.5. August, 84.55, the high, the low 83.30, the settlement 83.55, that finishing down 115. June lean hogs, 71.70, the high 70.10, the low 71.45, the final price, that down 55. July, 71.35, the high 69.45, the low finishing at 70.30, that down 110. August, 69.80, the high 68, even the low 69.65, the settlement, that down 35. October, 60.70, the high 59.55, the low, the settlement 59.82 and a half, and that down 80. July pork belly, 71.75, the high, the low 69.65, the settlement 71.67 and a half, that finishing up 92 and a half. That's the only positive sign we have here today from the Mercantile Exchange as far as where things finished the day. Let's take a look now at what is going on Wall Street. The Dow Jones Industrial Average is currently up 42 points at 10,509. The NASDAQ up 10 at 2079. The S&P 500 is up 6 points at 1197.
Agricultural information is made possible with support from ADM, helping to create a storehouse of possibilities and products from a single seed. ADM, resourceful by nature. Agricultural programming on WILL is made possible by Farm Credit Services of Illinois. Farm Credit Services of Illinois has been providing for farmers' credit and insurance needs for over 85 years, including real estate, operating and machinery loans, crop and life insurance protection, and programs for young and beginning farmers.
It's time once again to Ask Dr. Science. So let's ask Dr. Science.
That's me.
Remember, he knows more than you do.
That's right.
Matt Johnson from Honolulu, Hawaii writes, "Dear Dr. Science, how come I can fit my whole fist in my mouth and my friend can't?"
You and your friend have a special relationship. Gee, I can't imagine letting anyone stick his fist into my mouth, but then I take my personal space pretty seriously. Maybe your friend just can't force himself to stuff his fist into your mouth because he doesn't trust you. He worries you'll bite. Or maybe you have a thin, elegant, artistic hand and